This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, a lot of young children dream of becoming firefighters someday. They imagine the thrill and the drama and the feeling of being a hero. But it takes a special person to sustain that desire into adulthood, because firefighting is not just about the moment of crisis. It's also about the moments afterwards, when someone has lost their home or even a family member in a disaster. A firefighter is there. What is it really like to be a fighter firefighter? What makes a person want to run into buildings that everybody else is running out of? We're going to meet some professional firefighters today. Derek Clouston is a field service supervisor at the Office of the State Fire Marshal. He also volunteers at Eastside Fire Department and Stony Point Fire Department. Derek, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Carol Reardon, a captain at Durham Fire Department. Carol, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Also with us, David Jacobs, an emergency medical services coordinator at Durham Fire Department. David, welcome.
Thank you for having us here.
Derek, tell us about when you decided to become a firefighter.
Well, I grew up right next door to a volunteer fire department, and it was basically one of those things to where you're next to it day to day. I grew up, I seen the trucks leaving constantly, and my father was in public service. My grandfather actually was one of the charter members of the volunteer department when it started back in the early 60s. So it's, I guess, just one of those things that I was drawn to it, and it was right there next to me. So
were you always hanging around the firehouse?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was right next door. So.
So did you, I mean, did they take you on as a kind of an honorary, you know, sort of a student?
Well, back, you know, in the late 80s, I actually joined in 1987. And so at that time, we had what they had what they called a junior firefighter program. So I was 14 years old. So prior to that, you know, hanging around, there was the fire department. I lived on one side, the chief and his son, and we were all the same age. And so we all grew up together. And so, of course, we were always over there. And so as soon as I turned 14, they had a junior firefighter program enlisted in it. And it just – that program was basically designed to, you know, get people interested, young people interested into the fire department. And, you know, which a lot of it was just rolling the hose and cleaning up and just doing all those kind of jobs that nobody else wants to do. But that's part of paying your dues, I guess.
You did that. I understand that when you were 16, you really had an opportunity to act professionally, right?
Well, it was, you know When you look at the ability that you had at that time, and things change, I mean, evolve, you know, we were able to start taking classes, taking our certification classes and doing those types of things. And we were able to respond, and which today you can't do that because of the various laws and standards and regulations. And so, yeah, I mean, we had an incident to where we had a body shop explosion. It was a small body shop. It was a family run business, and it was just right behind the fire station, basically. And so when we arrived, of course, you know, we had two subjects that were burnt. They were actually taking a gasoline tank out of an exotic car, and it fell and ignited. And so, you know, very early on, it was one of those things where, you know, you kind of see that and you react to it. And, you know, it didn't take long for me to realize that's what I wanted to do. I was very fortunate in the fact that at 16 years of age, I knew that, hey, this is what I wanted to do. I wasn't one of those folks coming up to the end of their graduation high school and saying, what am I going to do with my life? Yeah. I pretty much knew what I wanted to get into.
It's interesting, though, that you'd been hanging around the fire department all that time, right next door to it, even involved in some of the activities. But really, that one episode where you see a local business person, probably somebody you knew or at least you knew about, mm-hmm. and you get to see, oh, this is – it's almost surprising to think that being that close, it took that to make you think, oh, wait a minute, this is what it's all about, huh?
That was one of the things. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of other things that go along with it because, I mean, if you think it's always going to be about that one, you know, the big one, so to speak, yeah. It's not. There's a lot of other things that go into it. You know, you got to look at the 2 years prior to that, and this is for any firefighter, anybody coming in considering the job as a career, even volunteering. You know, there's so much of a – it's such a small percentage or fraction of what we actually do is actually – those kinds of instances. There's a lot of training and preparation and maintenance and all those kinds of things that go into it. So you're ready to respond.
The fact that you endured the 2 years of that, right. Rolling the hose and training is really testament to the fact that you wanted to do this by that time. Carol, tell us about you. When did you decide you were going to be a firefighter?
Well, I was about 8 years old and watching a fire. It was a big woods fire in California, and looked at my mom and I said, Mom, if I ever go camping, I'm going to take fire hose with me. And I said, and when I grow up, I'm going to be a fire truck. So, but, all through high school and Durham was public safety, so it was police and fire. So I really didn't want to do the police end. And they split in 85, and I graduated in 86 and wanted to, get on the fire department. It took me a couple years to get on because there wasn't a lot of women in the fire service then, and I didn't really have role models. I didn't have, mentors, to kind of encourage me. And even my mother, she was like, "Ooh, are you really sure you want to do that? Do something else." And, now she's like the most proud of me, but she really didn't give me, that encouragement to do it. So it took me a couple years to get on before I got hired and been here ever since.
What was it like for you? Was it difficult being here?
It was very hard. The academy was really hard just because there was only 11 of us. And guess who didn't have a partner ever? Sometimes I did. I have a few. It's kind of ironic that the guys who supported me and have supported me the whole time are still with the fire department. So that's kind of ironic. That
when you say you didn't have a partner, what does that mean?
Like when you're doing stuff, you always partner up two as a partner. Like you tie your equipment off together. You do your drills together. And so my partner was always my training captain. That was hard because you don't have that camaraderie. You don't have that in the shower room, the guys, and you don't ever have anyone to like just, "Oh my God, that was so tough," or, just scream at or whatever. So it was hard. I had good family support. So I think that kept me going. But really, sometimes I'm like, I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I made it,
Were people explicit about why they wouldn't partner with you, afraid that you weren't up to it as a woman
or
any of that?
Well, any of the guys who did partner with me, the other ones would be like, "Oh, your wife, go tend to your wife." And, but it was so different. 25 years ago was so different than it is now. I just didn't feel welcome, So.
But you do now. Things are a little bit different.
Things are much different because I pick on the women now and I'm like, "Yeah, I paved the way for you to run over me," definitely different.
David Jacobs, tell us about your beginnings and how you decided to become a firefighter.
Well, mine was a little bit different. I didn't start out as a child wanting to be a firefighter. I worked in the retail, actually grocery, prior to my career with the fire department. My older brother, he was on the department, and I had always been looking for a career. To me, the retail business was a job. It wasn't a career. And I started spending time with him, talking about the day-to-day things that happen at work. He seemed to enjoy it more than anything else, especially growing up, and I knew how he was, very particular about what he did. So he seemed to really enjoy it, and so I started hanging around him, spending more time with him. He would take me by the fire station, introduce me to some of the folks that worked there. I was really envious of his schedule. It's kind of a weird, we do shift work. It's 24 hours on and 24 hours off. So every time I spoke with him, it looked like he was always off work.
That's the trick. That's how they get you in, right?
That was the hook. And every time I spoke with him, I was always at work because retail, I was doing 60, 70 hours a week. Yeah. So that was my first inkling into the fire service. But I have thoroughly enjoyed it ever since I've been a part of it.
So as you got into the training and all the rest that, we've heard about, Derek was talking about it, Carol, a little bit. Obviously, it's different. You realize there's a lot of work involved. Were there points along the way that you were hankering for a grocery store again?
No. No, once I got in, even with the training, it was a lot of hard work. Unlike Carol, I had my brother who, if I had issues or problems working on something, he would spend the time with me to help me review it. To study for tests, to do some of the physical aspects of using equipment. It's like I would go through class during the day, and then in the evening, if I had any issues, he was like a super Wikipedia reference for me that evening.
What about the transition? Was it difficult for you? Derek and Carol talk about pretty much starting out as young people and going right into the career. You had to make a transition. Was it difficult?
The biggest transition for me was the way, I guess, my schedule changed. Instead of doing the 8 to 12 hour a day retail, everything from stocking shelves to bagging to running cash registers to unloading trucks to a different shift on helping people. And that was the biggest thing that I guess that captured my attention at first, because no matter what crisis somebody was having when they called us. That was their worst day. We were there to make it better, and I've always enjoyed that.
Carol, you nodded when David said something about his brother being very particular, and your whole body went, oh, yeah.
What? Oh, his brother. We miss him. He left. He moved away. And he was one of the one when I was first here, he actually, like, welcomed me and supported me. And, I just can't. Like, those people that I just remember are so special.
Sounds like some of the compassion that you have to show on the job starts out with the compassion that you have to show for each other, because a lot of teamwork is involved, huh, Derek?
Yes. Nobody understands a firefighter better than another firefighter. You know, the things that you go through, the things that you're exposed to, and the time that you spend together. I mean, you know, when you think about it, you're spending a third of your life. And that's kind of – that's your extended family. That's the home away from home. And so, you know, when you live and work for 24 hours with a group of people, I mean, you know, you're going to have those relationships. You're going to develop those relationships. You know, you're going to have those times to where you're going to fight like a family, you know, and you know, and then you're going to be there for each other when it is bad. And so that relationship that you develop that, you know, Carol's talking about, you know, it's there and it's real. And so that's probably one of the most unique things about the fire service that you have from a lot of other professions is that's a third of your life. It's an extended family.
We'll talk more about that family relationship and how it plays out in the community as our conversation with firefighters Derek Clouston, Carol Reardon, and David Jacobs continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about firefighters, their everyday life, a bit different from what you see on TV. Derek Clouston's a field service supervisor at the Office of the State Fire Marshal. Carol Reardon, a captain at Durham Fire Department. David Jacobs, Emergency Medical Services Coordinator at Durham Fire Department. Derek, in our last segment, you talked about that story when you were 16 years old and you know, an explosion at a local business. That turned out okay. I'm sure you've had stories that that turned out pretty badly and are still living with you today.
Yeah, you know, that's what we do. You know, we respond to people on the absolute worst days of their life. And, you know, it's unfortunate, you know, when that does happen. Of course, you know, it's kind of like that family bond that I told you about. You know, you've got each other to lean on during that. And, you know, we had a multi-fatality fire back in 2007 that involved three children and a mother, unfortunately. There was nothing we could do when we got there. They were in a manufactured home, older, and just a lot of obstacles that we just couldn't overcome to make to save. And so, you know, those instances, you know, that's where you kind of got to lean on each other and know that, you know, we've done everything we could do, you know, and help each other with that, help the department through that, and also the community, you know, especially in tight-knit communities and smaller communities. Where everybody knows everybody, so to speak, you know, being there for them and helping them through that.
Is there a lot of second guessing, Carol? Derek talked about being able to say we did everything we can, but I'm guessing there might be some second guessing.
There is. I think kind of like especially after I had children, then like it became so personal to me. And we had a fire where a young girl was in the home and she was in the fire room. I mean, you know, I know there was nothing we could do, but we did all we could do. We entered, probably shouldn't have. And then after it was over, you could just see where my hands were and they were so close to grabbing her. And, you know, you're like, oh, if we had just been closer, you know, had we just been a little faster getting there, you know, it could have changed. But you just have to fall on your training and you have to fall on, you know, doing the best you can do. And at the end of the day, that's all we do. I'm well trained. You know, do work out of compassion. And I work, you know, I have good work ethic and work as hard as I can. Really, it's after situations like that, it's kind of how it's handled. You know, kind of a time when I thought I was going to leave the fire department because I'd had that. And then I had a young girl that was, you know, kind of assaulted and murdered. And, you know, I was like the one holding her when she passed. And, you know, it was just kind of those things. And I said, I can't do this anymore. And if I hadn't gotten help, and it was actually UNC Hospital that kind of came in and helped me, because I was like, I can't do this anymore. You know, I have children at home. And I still, you know, even to this day, and that was 20 years ago, well, not even 20, 15 years ago. And I still remember, you know, the way she smelled. I just remember so many things. And it's why we have to take care of our mental health, and we have to take care of that, because I see terrible things. I see people at their worst. I see, you know, and you have to, you know, do healthy things. You know, so many firefighters, they drink too much, I know, and they, you know, do things. And it's so important to get that help, you know, from people.
Well, what changed for you? I mean, the idea, you're going to see some of the same circumstances. You're going to smell some of the same smells. You may well have a situation again where you're that close and it didn't come out the way you wanted. You were about to leave. You didn't. What changed now in your thinking that allowed you to go back and say, I'm going to do it again, and I'm going to face perhaps the same failure?
Well, I have to take myself out of it, and I had to not make it so personal, and it's not, you know, I have to kind of, and that's why we have this terrible sense of humor. And if people heard some of the stuff we say, they would be like, what? You know, talk at the dinner table. And I just had to kind of take the personal side out of it and do it as it's a job, and it's, you know, and I do the best I can do. But I had to, it was not my child there. It was, you know, and what helped too was when I had to speak to the grand jury for the child, and the person who was doing my interview said, I have to tell you something. You have to know that the mother of this child found some peace knowing that a mother was holding her child, you know. And so that kind of, like, you say, you know what? I'm here for a reason. I definitely am on my engine for a reason. I know it. I feel it. So you just, you know, it's what I do.
David, you are EMS coordinator, so you're sending people out and making sure all those things, those pieces are in place. What do you do now these days to make sure that everybody is well adjusted?
Well, the biggest thing that Carol brought out is the training. That's what you fall back on when everything else is falling apart. You do what you've been trained to do. So we've went in different areas with our training. We've done online. We've done face-to-face where people come out to classroom settings. So now the goal is to mix those up and to make sure that I've got a good mixture of both. Technology has changed a little bit since I first got on the fire department. Like most people, my cell phone is more powerful than a laptop or computer 25 years ago. So that has brought some challenges, but it's also made things a little bit easier as far as getting the training done. And I try to make sure that everybody stays focused on the medical side of the house as to what they should do and how they should respond. We do scenarios occasionally where I'll bring them out and I'll present them with a medical crisis, and then we watch, not just myself, but I'll pick two or three other firefighters to help judge to see how well they responded to the whatever incident I gave them.
I understand that you had, there was a sad memory of yours that actually led to a change in the training around CPR. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, I guess it's been close to 20, 25 years ago. We were at a house fire, and everything went according to plan, but there was a mother and a child there, and the child was started having respiratory issues and went into cardiac arrest. And I was the first person in, myself and my captain. So we worked on the child. We did CPR. The paramedics arrived. They continued and were able to get a pulse back. And the child lived for a couple of days, and then sadly he died later on. But that made me a little bit more focused it made me a little bit more determined to make sure we were doing everything we could. But at the time I was on the engine company, so I didn't know how to implement that. Well, about 4 years ago, our former medical director, Dr. Richard Serra, wanted us to improve survivability from sudden cardiac arrest. So we started looking at how we were doing, and it was kind of dismal. just to give you some numbers, in North Carolina, the survival rate for sudden cardiac arrest is about 5%. I thought, okay, North Carolina, backwaters state, maybe we just don't know any better. So we started looking at other communities. New York was 5%. Chicago was 3%, and Detroit wasn't quite 1%. Of course, they have a whole host of other issues. I said, well, let's go out to the West Coast and see what they're doing out that way. California was about 8%, and Vegas was right in around that 7 or 8%. Then we discovered a place called Seattle, Washington.
Okay. Heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, you may have heard of them before. Well, they had survival rates that exceeded 50%.
Huh.
So it became my mission at that point to learn what they did. They host yearly what they call a resuscitation academy, and I was fortunate enough where the fire department sent me out there to learn their secrets, more or less. So we have a whole new focus on the way we manage a cardiac arrest, the way our personnel respond, how we do CPR. We've changed and modified it, and it has worked out really well. When we started this, we would get a pulse back on a cardiac arrest victim anywhere between 12 and 18% of the time. And last year, as an average, we were about 33%.
Wow. How about the survival rate? Has that changed?
Yeah, the survival rate also has went up for the entire community. So what we've done also, not only training our personnel, we started something that Seattle has in place. We started a fund where the public can donate to. It's called the Durham Fire Department Emergency Medical Fund. And we use that money to train the public in CPR at no cost. We just got going, so there's some other things we'd like to do, such as purchasing equipment and specialized training for our personnel. So for all the listeners out there that would like to know how they help their local fire department.
Is there a website?
Yeah, there is a website. Just go to the Durham Fire Department's website, and you can find out what you need.
I think it's awfully impressive. You've got a statistic that makes you look bad, and nobody likes to look bad with statistics. But you look at it and you say, I could take this personally and just cover up and say we're doing our jobs. Or I could look around and look and look and look. And the fact that you persisted and went all the way out to Seattle, for God's sake, so far, and said, you know, there's a place where this can be done better and we can do better, is just awfully impressive. That's what we expect sort of public officials to be doing. So congratulations on that. Derek, let me ask you if how much else has changed and whether or not we know that everything changed after 9/11. How about firefighting? Certainly, they were on the front lines.
Yeah, when you look at the fire service, I mean, you hear the story David just told about EMS, and when you look at, we can all think back to what we were talking about at the break. We were talking about, shows like Emergency and some of those, and how that kind of ushered in the era of EMS, fire-based EMS. And so, when you look at 9/11 and what that done, the fire department is no longer just a fire department. The fire department is basically an all hazards department. Some people might not want to embrace that, but when you look at a majority of the fire departments in the state of North Carolina, there's about 1,252 of them. But when you look at a majority of the fire departments that are out there, they're just not running fire calls anymore or fire incidents. They're running vehicle accidents, pin-in extrications. They're running water rescues. They're running structural collapses, confined space rescues, trench rescues. So when you look at the depth and the breadth of what we have to train these responders to, I mean, it's amazing to think that that you can take a group of people and put them in an environment to where they have to be able to make very technical and very crucial decisions, not by a committee, but very quickly, and be able to train them to respond to those various hazards that are within the communities. It speaks a lot to the type of people that are attracted to the fire to the fire service and what it does, and that type of personality that it takes to excel in it, and those. Those characteristics are very hard to find, and so I think that defines us quite well.
And again, so all of the technical specs, understanding if there's hazardous and which hazardous, and how you'd handle it, all of those very technical details. And we've talked a little bit about compassion and how important that is. When you're on a call, do you think about the aftermath? You've had enough experience now with families who've lost everything. Mm-hmm. Maybe the whole family survived, but then they start thinking about everything inside. Do you now think about, and I'll start with you, Derek, and then go to Carol, trying to save stuff on the inside, trying to save memorabilia? Does that come to mind?
Well, one of the things we do is after every fire, we try to do what we call salvage and overhaul. And if there are pictures, if there are toys, maybe we try to get them covered up under our tarps so that there's not any water damage. A kid who has lost his room in his mind, he didn't just lose his house, he lost his room. Right. Just that one little item may be able to help him Families love it when we can get pictures down off the wall and secure them, because some of those are irreplaceable. They may only have that one photo. So despite the tragedy of the moment, that's just kind of the little things that we can do to make it a little bit better. And then if the family needs to cry, then we're right there with them. If they need a hug, we'll give it to them.
Carol, I was wondering, you talked about the fact that there was a young victim who died in your arms, and the mother said she was happy to know that she died in the arms of a mother. Is there an expectation that women are going to be more compassionate, and do you feel a kind of pressure to be the compassion arm of the fire department?
Well, I definitely think everyone has their role in the fire department. I mean, I'm never going to be this macho, you know, Hulk that just can tear things up, and you know, so everyone has to have a role, and I feel that I definitely bring a little more compassion to my truck. That's just the nature. I'm a mom, you know, I'm a mom first. I'm a firefighter, and so it definitely, I definitely think women will bring a little softer side. You know, there's probably women that'd be like, I can't believe she just said that, but you know, but I'm a nurturer, you know, that's
well, do you and I'm just wondering if everybody has felt that. Well, first of all, I think women now make up maybe just under 3.5% nationwide of the force.
Definitely fewer women. East Coast, we seem to be a little bit further behind than the West Coast, you know, and for numbers. We're growing. You know, we want good women here. It is harder. I wish that women knew what a great opportunity they have. I've been a full-time mom. It has afforded me a lot of opportunities with my children. And I think if we can break that kind of stereotype, although I still have people call the station and they're like, oh, are you the secretary? You know, so, I mean, we got to educate the community, too, you know, that, no, we fight fire. We go in, you know.
David, have you seen that change discrimination against women and just how firefighters, particularly male firefighters, feel about women?
When I was hired, we did have women firefighters here. I guess I was so focused on my own performance and surviving and my jubilation that I wasn't stocking grocery shelves anymore. Perhaps I didn't focus on that aspect as much, but we do have more women today. And I think, especially coming from the training side of the house, we try to treat everybody the same regardless. We don't want to show favoritism to anybody. So if one person is expected to be able to carry X amount of weight, we expect everybody to be able to carry X amount of weight. And I don't see any singling out, if that's kind of what your question was getting at, today. And I don't feel it personally. In fact, we're pretty aggressive if we saw somebody doing something like that.
What about, Derek, do you think, though, again, in any profession, you've got people on a spectrum, right? There are the sort of, there's going to be more macho and more compassionate, if that is a binary, I don't know. But do you try to figure that out and say, look, this team is really suited to that? I mean, you talked about all the specialties and the advanced knowledge that you now need to be in this profession. Is there a time when you say, look, this team is better suited for that application and this team is better over there because of their personalities?
Well, yes, that's the role. I think that's true in any profession that you have. You know, you have to know the strengths of your people, and you're definitely going to play to those strengths. And, you know, you definitely want to train your people to be able to excel in all the areas that you got. But, you know, at the end of the day, you definitely want to put the people in the positions, you know, to be there. You know, because it is, at the end of the day, it's about the people who are having the worst day of their lives. You know, so you got to make sure, as a leader within an organization, I think, to say, this is how we're going to handle this, and we're going to put these people in place to make sure that we're doing the best we can do for those people that we're there to serve.
But that gets back to your worry that the some women out there are going to, you know, if you're going to discriminate based on a prejudice about who might be better at what, that's when you're going to get in trouble. But when your experience has told you, male or female, black or white, these are the people who are best suited because of my experience with them and not because of the prejudice I brought to it, then you might have a better team and make a better decision. It's when you made it before you knew who that person was. I think that gets you out of the frying pan. When you get back.
I like to be in the frying pan.
All right, then. The other thing, I guess, in terms of compassion, Carol, is the idea that when you arrive at the scene, I mean, this is one of the big distinctions between firefighters and police. The police have to decide who the good guy is and who the bad guy is, and you can't care, right?
you treat everyone the same. You have to treat, you know, I've treated people that have just done horrific things, and you treat them the same, because that's not, it's not for me to judge. I'm there for to do my job, and that's what we're going to do. Probably makes some people mad sometimes, you know, but everyone gets treated the same.
Yeah, but that's got to be different, difficult, right, David? I mean, you know that this thing got started because somebody was doing the wrong thing. They were doing a drug deal or something went down. They might have gotten off scot-free. Now you're dealing with somebody who's got hurt because of it. Is it hard?
In some ways it may be, but we always try to fall back on the understanding that whoever has done what are citizens. And we are here to protect and take care of the citizens, regardless of what we think. And we have a role to function to do that. So, again, through training, everybody's taught to treat everybody the same, no different. Everybody gets the same level of care. And if it's not, then that's something that we have to try to adjust or address later on.
On the State of Things today, we are meeting the profession of firefighting. David Jacobs is an emergency medical services coordinator at Durham Fire Department. Carol Reardon, a captain at Durham Fire Department. Derek Clouston is field service supervisor at the Office of the State Fire Marshal. And our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about firefighting, a job that is often glorified. There are TV versions, and then there's the real version, and we're getting some of that today with Derek Clouston, who's field service supervisor at the Office of the State Fire Marshal, David Jacobs, emergency medical services coordinator at Durham Fire Department, and Carol Reardon, captain on the Red Devil.
Yay.
What is the Red Devil?
The Red Devil is my engine.
Yeah?
It's engine 3. It's back in 1911, they purchased a new engine for the station. It wasn't horse-drawn anymore. It was a real motorized engine.
Wow. 1911.
In 1911. Wow. And they named it then the Red Devil. In fact, they were so worried that the engine wouldn't work because it was motorized, they would still pull the steamer engine behind it when they would go to fires.
Whoa. That took a couple extra horses,
yeah,
right?
Because that's big. It has been in East Durham for over 100 years.
Wow. Obviously, they've updated it since then.
We are. We are in a Supfin. We have a nice engine. We're pretty happy with it.
Did anybody save the old? Is the old one in an archive or a museum somewhere?
They have the steamer. They don't have the motorized.
Wow.
The original, the first Red Devil. But we have Red Devil on the truck. And, like, you know, we're like, yeah, we're on the devil. You don't even say engine 3. You're like, yeah, I'm on the devil.
Everybody knows what that is. Is there a certain pride in the machinery, the equipment, or a history of a particular engine, Derek?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's amazing. You go across the state, you know, and you see the pride. I mean, that is one thing that you see. Firefighters have a very unique sense of pride in not only the equipment they ride on, but also their stations. And you know, I mean, when you see that, I mean, your life is dependent on that equipment, you know, and what it does. And so you're very meticulous about how you care for it, how you maintain it. And so there's a lot of pride that goes in that, especially in the volunteer communities where, you know, there's a lot of fundraisers and things of that nature going to help pay for some of this equipment in a lot of parts of the state. And so, you know, when you think about that, there's a lot of kind of blood, sweat, and tears that goes in that. It's just not something, you know, it's just, you know, here it is. It's a lot of bingos and raffles and chicken dinners and everything else that goes to pay for it.
When you think about it, it's sort of it's like Grandfather's Axe, right? We call it Grandfather's Axe, but we've changed the handle 4 times and it's had 3 new heads, right? But it's Grandfather's Axe. So the idea that this engine, even though the original is long gone, is the thing that you attach this thing. Well, and what about the downtime? I mean, again, we talked about the glory, but David, when you watch, if you do, any of the TV renditions of your profession, how do you feel about them, and how do they vary from what goes on day to day?
I think Emergency was one of the last shows I watched. I don't typically watch any of the shows today because I don't want to get upset. I've got friends. I've made friends across the country, and I would probably call them and make fun of them. But typical day, we don't have tons of downtime. Our day starts at 7 a.m. First thing everybody does is they check their equipment, the trucks, make sure everything's in working order. There's a light cleaning around the station. Any last-minute coffee or sandwiches are taken at that time. And then there's usually 2-3 hours of some sort of morning training that happens, be it fire training, EMS training, which they all love to come to, And then there's lunch. And then from the afternoon, it picks up and kind of repeats that. Then in the evening, there's dinner. And then if you consider downtime, that happens there. But you have to remember, during all of this time, they're running calls. You have some trucks a little bit busier than others. We may have one truck that may run 10, 14 calls within their 24-hour shift. And we have some trucks that may only run two or three calls. So it kind of varies there a little bit.
Carol, I know you're not crazy about TV version of firefighters.
No, I'm not. My husband watches this horrible show. And it just,
makes
me, it's Chicago Fire. It just makes me so mad. They have two women in the academy, and one of them's a cheater, and one of them can't do the job. You know, they could have had this great moment to represent female firefighters, you know, in the national spotlight, and they just blew it. And just, it was just a good opportunity. I mean, 100% of the women are terrible. Like, you know.
Well, you know, Carol, if they actually portrayed men cheating, no one would believe it.
Wow. I'm shooting daggers right now.
He said it.
Yes, that was Frank Station.
That was Frank Station.
I just wanted to see how long the silence would go before they said, I don't want to insult the guy. It's his show. But what the heck is he talking about? But downtime, too. And there's a little bit of rolling hose and sweeping the floors. Some of that. What about checkers? Derek, do we – because that's – no checkers?
Those are those perceptions we're still having to fight. You know, a lot of people think, well, they work 24 hours a day. What do they do?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's you know, on the paid side of the house, there is a lot of that misconception. I mean, you know, just like David was talking about, you know, there's a lot of things that go on. You know, and here's the other thing about, you know, most people come to work, you know, they work 8 to 5. They go home, they cook dinner, and they get to relax. So the other thing is, I mean, I've been on shifts to where, you know, you work all the way through, and then you know, after 12 o'clock, you get up 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting a full night's sleep. And then, you know, on your days off, a lot of firefighters have, you know, secondary employment, things like that. So, you know, sleep is a precious commodity sometimes.
So. A lot of health risk, David. I understand, too, cardiovascular disease is a very important concern. And, in fact, some changes have been made as a result.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest killers of firefighters. It's not falling through the floor or the roof at the big fire. It's the cardiovascular issue that we're concerned with. So we've implemented changes ever since the early 90s. We have a physical fitness program. And once a year now, firefighters come out to our training facility, and we put them on a treadmill. We make them do some stretching and flexing, lifting weights, and other things. And the whole time we're monitoring their blood pressure and their heart rate. And if there are any drastic changes that we notice, we'll give them a few minutes to kind of relax and calm down, take a deep breath. But if it's not corrected, then we send them directly to our physician who manages our firefighter wellness program.
And there was another equipment change that had to be made that helped as well. Tell us about that.
Well, we purchased treadmills for all of the stations, including all of the stations have some sort of weight room or some sort of weight sort where the folks can get in there and do their own workout. We also give them an hour or so off each day, or not literally off, but an hour of time allotted where they can either go to a track, they can go to a gym to do some sort of exercise to make sure that we're in compliance.
And, Derek, I understand that the tones or just the way firefighters are alerted had to change because they noticed that that was causing a particular spike in heart rate.
Yeah, if you look at it, if your normal heart rate at rest is about 60 beats a minute when you're asleep, and so at 2 o'clock in the morning when the old what we call the bell hits, the old bells or even some of the claxtons, that would cause a sharp increase in the heart rate, which was also unhealthy for that. So now they have what they call low cardiac tones. They start off very low, very soft, and they rise in intensity to help kind of wake the person up.
This is not like you don't have like Siri saying.
No, we don't have
Derek,
that. No.
There's a fire.
No, it still happens pretty quick. It's just not knocking you out of the bed. So
but that's great. And again, it talks about the research that has to go on, and everybody adjusting to the research that fires are still fires. But there's a lot going. Well, what about family life in your family? I'll start with you, Carol. What kind of impact does your schedule and your career have on their lives?
My children have no interest in the fire department, which has always made me sad. You know, I've been fortunate. I haven't missed too much. I have missed some Christmases and birthdays, but when they were younger, you know, I could lie and say, oh, no, today's Christmas. I think one big impact was my children never really paid attention to what I did, and they never really paid any attention until after 9/11. I know after 9/11, they kind of, my son, he started having some anxiety, you know, and kind of was like, oh, you have to go to work. Please don't go to work, you know. And that was tough, you know, but it opened up good conversation, you know, about life and mortality and stuff. So I do wish I had a child that would follow me, but I don't think that's going to happen. I can maybe hope for grandchildren, I guess.
Well, you never know. I mean, and you remember, your mom did not want you to be, so you disappointed her for a moment.
Yes,
and
I
then
did.
It all turned out. So you got to give them some time. Did they ever tell you to just plan? Well, quit. I guess they were discouraging you at a certain point.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. My daughter, especially the youngest, she really, you know, was like, please. And that was like the worst phone calls you'd get. I'd be at work, and you know, I know the guys were like, what the hell is she doing? I'm crying. You know, some of the guys were like, that's something I never thought I'd see at the station, crying females. So, you know, she would be, please, mommy, come home, you know. And I did have to go home a couple times, you know, just because if I can't, I'm so focused on my children, I really can't do a job. You know, I can't give a good service, 100% service to the citizens. So, you know, there was a tough year or so, just, you know, dealing with their stress. And, you know, my kids are first always.
But as you said, you did deal with it and you had a conversation that maybe you couldn't have before. And
we definitely talk about, you know, their mortality and life, and bad things happen. And it definitely, and my kids and I are all very close, and we talk about everything. My kids talk to me about everything now. And I really do think that it started from there. It definitely opened up conversations.
What about you, David? The family, the impact on your family?
A little bit easier on my side, being on the single side. I've never been married. I don't have kids. So I was probably more of a company man, where it doesn't bother me to stay in the office now later or get there a little bit earlier or do some Saturdays. So that really didn't impact me from that perspective. My brothers and sisters, obviously, they, just like anybody else, would worry. 9/11, you know, it opened everybody's eyes to the potential where good people could be killed or injured in one event. So maybe a few more dinners at their houses, a couple more, hey, be careful, or a couple more texts, especially my sister, you know, love you, tell me what the weather's like. She and I have got this thing about bad weather, so we're always texting each other, hey, it's time to go to the bathroom, okay, or get in the bathtub because severe weather's coming.
Tornado's on the way, right?
Yeah.
So, not a hygiene question.
Yeah, right. No,
I just want to clear that up.
Yeah, never.
You'd never live that one down if we didn't. Derek, let me talk to you about this question, and I think Carol raised an issue too. 9/11, the kids see it on the screen. All of a sudden, they realize mommy's got a dangerous profession, which means, on the one hand, we know kids are a little oblivious, partly, but also, is it difficult to talk about that? It might be that you didn't want to talk, Carol, too much about exactly how much danger you were in. Is it hard to have that honest conversation at home about how dangerous this is?
I can only speak for my wife, and you know, when we met very early on, we met in college, and I was already in the fire department as a volunteer, and she knew very early on what I wanted to do. I mean, it was obvious. I mean, it's a package deal. I mean, it's one of those things where, hey, this is me. This is what I'm about, and this is what I want to do for my career. This is what I want to do for a living. And you know, but you know, the one dynamic, and Carol spoke to this. You know, your children do change that. I can tell you that. You know, my son, who's 8 years old now. You know, he doesn't really see that mortality thing yet. He doesn't quite pick up. He sees the big truck and going around and doing all those kinds of things that we do. And he, you know, it hasn't clicked. And I'm sure the conversation is going to come. But it is something that you have to be cognizant of, you know. And a lot of times, you know, we try to compartmentalize our lives. You know, I don't necessarily come home every time that you've had a close call or something almost happened and say, man, let me tell you what happened, you know, because you don't want them worrying about you more than they probably already are. But you do have to have those discussions, you know, when it does happen. You know, you got to be very open. You know, you have to be very honest about it.
I think any profession that encourages people to talk honestly about difficult things and encourages them to be in better communication and have more meals together, not a bad profession.
Right.
It's the 24 hours on and off part that's got me off, so I'm not going to do it. All right, so you talked about humor at one point early on in the program, and I'm sure that is part of the way that you get through this. And I'm sure that there are jokes. Every profession has them. So this is the time in the program when we meet our profession and we meet the humor in the profession. Tell us a joke. Tell us a joke, Derek. Oh, you've got that glint in your eye. Tell us a joke that you like to tell.
I got to be careful. I got to drive home. But,
I have to have a job, so right, you know, within the bounds of propriety.
We'll take one for the team. Yeah. The fire service is no different than much like the military. I mean, we're a paramilitary organization, you know. And just like you see in the military, you got inter-service rivalries between the various services, you know. Firefighters and law enforcement, we get along, but we like to jab each other. So probably one of the funniest ones I ever heard is, you know, I tried for years to be a cop, and I couldn't. I kept scoring too high on the test. I had to be a firefighter. So that's one that you hear a lot of. So cops don't like that one too much, but it is what it is.
They're armed, by the way. You know that, don't you?
Hey, it is what it is.
He does not work for Durham.
No, I don't. Volunteer. So, yeah. Like I said, it's all in good fun.
All in good fun. We kid you because we love you. Yeah. David?
Right. Oh, I'm not a great joke teller.
Yeah.
I think probably one of the funnier things, though, that happened to me in my career is we had purchased – this has been, oh, Lord – at least 20 years ago, we had purchased a new ladder truck. It was a Grumman. And 6 months into it, I had a little bump up with it. So I was told that I had christened the brand new fire truck. So for about the next 3 or 4 months, there were Lego toys that were crashed. There were wrecked cars that were found its way in my bed that were broken. So I was reminded constantly that I had broke the brand new, at that time, $500,000 fire truck.
Ooh. They fixed it. It's still running.
Oh, it's still running. It was just running. A minor little scratch on it.
How about it, Carol?
Okay. How can you tell the female firefighter's locker?
I don't know. How can you tell?
There's going to be 20 pair of fire boots in front of it.
Carol, you told that joke. You are the most courageous woman I know. That's pretty great. I want to thank all of you for being on the program, and certainly thank you for your service. Carol Reardon, a captain at Durham Fire Department, David Jacobs, Emergency Medical Services Coordinator at the same Durham Fire Department, and Derek Clouston is Field Service Supervisor at the Office of the State Fire Marshal. He also volunteers at East Side Fire Department and Stony Point Fire Department. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. We're going to be in Greensboro live tomorrow. If you want to join us at the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage, just send us an email, rsvp@wunc.org, and you can be part of the audience. It's going to be a good show, Brother Wolf, which is a kind of musical rendition of Beowulf, Appalachian style. We're going to have some music. Laura Lynn Dawson will be there. Riley Bogus, live music, and lots of news as well. So if you want to join us at the Upstage Cabaret Triad Stage in Greensboro, send us an email, rsvp@wunc.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Megan Mataferi, and Anita Rao. Will Michaels as well. Our intern, Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is the technical director, and Brent Wolf is the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.